Support for WILL comes from Busey. With more than 145 years of experience, Busey understands the benefits healthy businesses provide the local economy. Proudly partnering with the business community since 1868. Busey, your dream, our promise.
From the Latin DeCrantier University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's Veterans Day, November the 11th, 2015. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets. No, we won't, because I'm traveling today to the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. However, I have a really good interview with Aaron Hager about a four-step plan that includes Liberty Link soybeans to control weeds in your fields. Aaron is passionate about this plan and what it might do to help producers across the Midwest and certainly in Illinois and Indiana to create a better program of weed control on their farms. We'll listen to him and hear more about that four-step plan as we make our way through this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, I'm traveling today to the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. Should have arrived within the last couple of hours, but just to be on the safe side, pre-produced our programming for this afternoon. So no update of the CME Group numbers from Chicago, the trade there at the Chicago Board of Trade for this Wednesday afternoon. It is Veterans Day. Thank you to all those who have served our country. We do truly appreciate the time that you took out of your lives to protect the freedom that is democracy in the United States of America. A couple of items just to keep you up to speed on. Of course, the Farm Assets Conference is coming up at the end of this month. If you haven't picked up your tickets, I urge you really to do this right now, trying to get a good count on how many people will be there at 800-898-1065. You can come the day of, but it will be difficult if a whole bunch of you come and we have to feed you because, well, hotels don't like that to happen with a whole bunch of folks. So please do call in right now, 800-898-1065, to get your tickets or go online at farmassetsconference.com. Should be a fantastic day. As you already well know, many of our analysts will be there, including Jerry Golke of the Golke Group out of Chicago, and Sue Martin is going to fly in from Webster City, Iowa. So come and visit with them. Hear a bit more about big data, about the price of farmland, about nutrient loss off your farm, and potentially some regulatory problems that might be created if they're not controlled a little better. There are three easy steps that you can do. The Farm Assets Conference is the 24th day of November.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, offering financial products and services specifically for the agricultural industry, including farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing, as well as farm cash management solutions.
Let's recap the numbers now as they came out from the United States Department of Agriculture yesterday for the World Agricultural Supply Demand Estimates and the crop production figures. For the crop production, corn forecast at 13.7 billion bushels. That was up less than a percentage point from the October forecast, down 4 points from last year's record crop, but still based on conditions as of November the 1st. Yields are expected to average nationwide 169.3 bushels to the acre. That's 1.3 bushels better than it was in October, but 1.7 bushels below last year. If realized, this would be the second highest yield and third largest production for corn on record in the United States. Total U.S. corn use for the 15-16 fiscal year is projected at 100 million bushels lower, with exports lowered some 50 million bushels. U.S. corn export sales and shipments, USDA says, lag well behind last year at this time, and supplies remain uncompetitive in many foreign markets as corn from Brazil continues to undercut U.S. offerings. U.S. corn ending stocks for the 15-16 season projected 199 million bushels higher at 1.76 billion bushels. The season's average cash price for corn received by producers projected 15 cents lower on both ends this month to $3.35 on the low end and $3.95 per bushel on the top end.
Support comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason on this Wednesday afternoon. This is the closing market report from Illinois Public Media. Visit us online at willag.org. There you can order your tickets for the Farm Assets Conference, farmassetsconference.com, or call 800-898-1065. Last week, I talked with Aaron Hager, weed scientist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, about some serious problems farmers have been having with resistant weeds in both corn and soybeans and how to control them. He's come up with a four-step plan. It's posted to the Bulletin website. That's bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu. I asked Aaron about the plan and what it entails.
One of the significant concerns that we have with weed management in 2016 is, though, really revolves around systems that still continue to try to rely on a single tool or tactic. And the unprecedented weather challenges that many in Illinois experienced during 2015 really highlight the fact that we may have every good intention about making a very timely post-application in corn or soybean, but reality of it is nature really holds all the trump cards. And if that's the only weed management approach that we're going to do in our cropping system, what 2015 showed us really highlighted the perils of doing that, because in many of the fields that we observed across the state, that weed management, this post-only approach was not applied in a timely manner because of wet field conditions. It was pretty easy to look at these fields and determine that yield loss had already taken place by the time that that post-application had taken place. And so what we're really trying to get folks to consider is that what we do in managing weeds does not increase your yield at all. Everything that we do to manage weeds effectively tries to preserve that inherent genetic yield potential of the hybrids or varieties that you've elected to plant. Weeds do nothing to increase yield. All they do is they function to reduce crop yield. And so by a good integrated management program that keeps the ability of weeds from actually reducing that by competing too long with their crop, we're actually allowing that crop to express that genetic yield potential that most farmers look to and decided upon, this is the variety, this is the hybrid that I want based on its yield potential. If we don't invest in a very sound weed management program, it's very unlikely that that high-yielding hybrid or high-yielding variety is ever going to be able to express that genetic yield potential if the weeds are allowed to interfere and compete too long.
This is about cost-cutting measures that producers might try to deploy next year, and really about the balance between preserving yield and improving your potential for yield.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to considerations that farmers are making right now in areas that they may try to reduce expenditures going into 2016, we certainly understand the reasons for this. There are many different ways that you can go about reducing your weed control or your weed management costs, but we simply caution folks to not trim too deeply or too much when it comes to your programs in 2016. Partly because in many fields that we saw this year, there's been a huge return of weed seeds back into the soil seed bank. So many of the populations, weed populations that we'll encounter in 2016 are going to be very, very dense. So we're putting forward the idea of consider your investments in weed control or weed management as simply that. It's an investment. It's not necessarily a cost that you do not receive a return from. The investment in adequately managing weeds in either corn or soybean pays itself back in full at the end of the year with more bushels in the grain cart during harvest time. And we've actually run through an example of a scenario that I think is a real-world scenario, that if a farmer, say, in a soybean field elected not to use an integrated program, they decided on a post-glyphosate-only weed management program, whether or not the farmer knew or accepted the fact that the water hemp in the field was resistant to glyphosate. And so the idea would be we'll only use glyphosate post-emergence. Well, if you run through some scenarios and some numbers, if you look at, say, a fairly modest yield loss of, say, 20% due to season-long interference of the water hemp, if you look at a soybean yield potential in that field of 65 bushels to the acre at $9 soybean, you can do the math yourself, and all of a sudden you realize that by trying to save a little bit, maybe cut a little bit too deeply in your weed management program up front, at the end of the year you actually lost well over $100 an acre because of the yield loss that occurred in that field because you simply could not manage that weed population, or you allowed that population to compete or interfere with the soybean crop for way too long.
In the second part of the series, you take up resistance, why it remains, and then some about post-application herbicides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the issues of resistance that occur not only in Illinois but in many other states in the Midwest continues to grow each and every year. This is not something that, you know, the weed scientists at universities are making up to try to, you know, scare people into change. This is reality. This is happening. And we see this more and more frequently throughout the last 10 to 15 years here in the state of Illinois. If you look at the sheer number of samples that have been submitted this year in 2015 to the University of Illinois Plant Clinic for resistance screening, there was over 1,700 samples submitted this year. And even though we really haven't put the data together yet to look at how many of those actually tested positive for resistance, if you simply consider the sheer number of samples that were submitted this year, that strongly suggests that this problem of resistance is not going to go away, and it's not. And also keep in mind also that it's just not the most significant issue that farmers are going to be facing with resistance. It's not just the resistance in, say, water hemp to glyphosate, but rather what happens when water hemp plants or populations begin to accumulate resistance to more than one herbicide. And so if our plan, if our strategy for 2016, well, I'm going to continue to grow a glyphosate-resistant soybean variety, and all I'm going to do is I'm going to tank mix glyphosate with a foliar-applied PPO inhibitor, that may be completely ineffective if you have plants or populations that have evolved resistance to both glyphosate and the PPO inhibitors. And so then again, you know, you're looking at a fairly significant yield loss scenario if we're not able to adequately and timely control the water hemp populations in the crops.
We're talking with University of Illinois Extension weed scientist Aaron Hager today about resistant weed control in the 2016 growing season. I made note that in the third part of the series posted in the Bulletin website at bulletin.illinois.edu, or just search Google for Bulletin, University of Illinois Extension, and it will come up. In the third part of the series, you talk about effective weed control. What do you mean?
There's been quite a renewed interest for the last 2 to 4 years about using more than one herbicide to try to control some of the problematic species, in particular the resistant biotypes. And many times if you look at the herbicide products that are commercially available, there's many premix combinations that farmers can select from in either corn or soybean. Some of these are two-way premixes or three-way premixes, or even a premix that has four different herbicide active ingredients contained within it. So the idea of multiple versus effective, we really try to promote the effective or the use of effective herbicides, multiple effective herbicides against the resistant population. But you have to understand what makes up the premixes. Because even though a premix may have more than one herbicide active ingredient, it may have herbicides that represent more than one site of action within the plant, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily synonymous with having effective target sites. They say, for example, if you selected to use a soil-applied premix product that had a PPO inhibitor, a group 14 herbicide, combined with an ALS inhibitor or a group 2, and this was a strategy that you were trying to use multiple effective herbicides against an ALS-resistant water hemp population, the reality of it is that you do have multiple herbicides, but you have only one effective herbicide in that particular combination. And you need to think about this not only with your selection of soil-applied herbicides, But think of this also in your selection of post-applied herbicides, whether it be mixes or combinations that you can purchase as a premix, or that you do the tank mix combinations by themselves. And I'll give you another example of if you had a water hemp population that is resistant to glyphosate. If you elected to try to control that with a mixture, either a premixture or a tank mixture, of glyphosate and dicamba, you do not have two effective sites of action in that application. You have only one.
Why is that the case?
If the glyphosate-resistant population is there, then glyphosate is no longer effective against it, and dicamba would be the only selective effective herbicide in that particular combination.
You know, last year, many farmers will say, well, it rained so much. Mm-hmm. I tried, and I used glyphosate, went over the top, just like normal. I'm fine with that. The rain just caused it not to be effective. I'm coming back anyway, because it's the most effective tool I think I have, and it's not only that, but it's also cost-effective. Mm-hmm. Is that the right thought?
It's probably not the right thought, simply because that the fact that resistance does not just manifest itself completely in 1 year. It's very likely that the year that it becomes very obvious that glyphosate or any other herbicide is not effective, you've had that population in place for, who knows, 2, 3, perhaps 4 or 5 years before that. And so it really depends upon how you want to define effective. If you've actually lost yield because of the weed populations that maybe a small percentage of the plants you haven't controlled in the past, now all of a sudden this year it manifests itself to where it's at a level that's very, very obvious to see. Who knows what the yield loss potential could be?
Fine. I'll just use dicamba beans in that case.
Technology is right now not available to do that. Both the dicamba-resistant technology and the 2,4-D-resistant technology at this time, those traits have not received all of the export-import approvals that they would need, for example, into the Chinese marketplace. And then furthermore, as of the time that we're doing the interview, dicamba has not been labeled for applications to dicamba-resistant soybeans. So we're really cautioning people, if this is an idea, if this is a technology that farmers are really going to try to depend on in 2016, it would be very, very advisable to have a good integrated backup plan in case these technologies are not available in 2016.
Have you written one for me? Four steps?
Yes, we have. Actually, we've our last installment in considerations for 2016 would be to consider, in soybean especially, a technology that is available and will be available in ample supplies in 2016, and that is a glufosinate-resistant soybean or the Liberty Link soybean system. And many times we've heard either custom applicators or farmers say, well, you know, that system is not as simple as the Roundup Ready system. And if you accept the fact that if you try to use Liberty like you do Roundup, it probably is going to fail as many times as it's going to be effective. We have to really think about how we're going to use a Liberty Link system. It's not that complicated. But it's not just the fact that we go and load up the spray tank with Liberty and go spray the beans in there and they're clean at the end of the year. Many times that would work, but the probability of having success with the Liberty Link system is much greater if we think about the entire system as a whole, beginning with planting time, selection of appropriate residual herbicides, timely post applications, and scouting that take place after the initial post. These are things that we have done before the widespread adoption of the glyphosate-resistant technologies. We did these things. We did use residual herbicides, we did make timely post applications, and we did follow up scouting. So it's really nothing that we haven't done before. It's a lot of the things that we haven't been doing actively for the last several years, but they're things that if we do these, if we understand how we're going to use the Liberty Link traits and technology, it can be very, very effective against some of these resistant populations that we're dealing with right now and will be dealing with again in 2016.
Is this the only option? Because it sounds a bit like a commercial.
It's an option. If you don't have any resistance issues on your farm right now, you're in the best position. You can take a lot of these different traits, integrate them into your system, use multiple effective herbicides to try to slow the evolution of resistance on your particular field. As of right now, given the widespread occurrence that we see of multiple resistance in our water hemp populations to glyphosate and to the PPO inhibitors, if you had a population, in, let's say in soybean, where individual plants were resistant to both glyphosate and the PPO inhibitors, if you are in a Roundup Ready system, if you are in a conventional soybean system, you have no effective post-herbicides.
Thanks so much, Aaron.
You bet.
Aaron Hager is an extension weed scientist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You can read his four-step program on the Bulletin website. I'll post a link into our own website at willag.org. Search Bulletin, by the way, on Google. Bulletin, comma, University of Illinois Extension should be the first thing to come up. It's bulletin.ipm.illinois.edu. Speaking of the Will Ag website, I'd like you to visit there, not for the Farm Assets Conference, but we'll talk about that again in just a moment, but just to listen to our ag programming. You know, I know you're busy and that you don't always get the opportunity to listen to us when we're live. That's fine, because we post our programming not long after it airs on our radio stations, and in the case of Commodity Week, prior to the time it airs on the radio stations, up at willag.org from the opening market report to the closing market report and everything in between throughout the day in its entirety, and then Commodity Week up on the website at willag.org. If you're a podcast user, for instance, using iTunes, if you search for either the Closing Market Report or Commodity Week, you'll find them there as well. Quick, easy, simple way to stay up to speed on what's happening in the futures markets. And with your favorite analysts, they're always posted to the website and into the iTunes podcast feed, the Closing Market Report, Commodity Week, and all of the rest of the ag programming from willag.org. There on that site, you can also pick up your tickets for the Farm Assets Conference, which is coming up at the end of this month. It's the 24th day of November, the Tuesday prior to Thanksgiving. Our thanks go to the Illinois Corn Growers Association, along with the Beef Association, the Pork Association, many of the other associations in the state that are participating with us, including the Soybean Association, to help keep down the cost on this one, just $30. And that includes the parking at the Marriott Hotel and Conference Center right next door in the parking deck. And we'll leave those gates open all day long so you can come and go as you please there. And then also the meal at the noon hour. Now, we do ask that you pre-register, or hope that you pre-register for this event, simply because hotels, those who are trying to put together meals, if we have an expansive number of folks that walk in on that day, then we'll have a problem. If you pre-register now, we'll have you already put in place, and we'll be sure to have a meal for you. It's at 800-898-1065 or online at farmassetsconference.com. Pick up your tickets. They're really quick, simple, easy to do. In either case, it's just $30, but I really do need you to register right now. We're coming up on that time where I kind of need to have a beginning thought on the total number of folks that will be in Bloomington Normal on the 24th day of this month, the Farm Assets Conference. Get your tickets right now. willag.org, farmassetsconference.com, 800-898-1065. When we come back, more from the Closing Market Report right here at Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
It's National Sunday Day. It's also St. Martin's Day, patron of harvests, horses, and innkeepers. On this day in agricultural history in 1790, chrysanthemums were introduced to England from China. Both the greens and blossoms are edible and are especially popular in Japan, China, and Vietnam. In 1933, the first great dust storm occurred on the Great Plains. A massive drought and decades of farming techniques where the fertile soils of the Great Plains were exposed through the removal of prairie grasses led to clouds of black dust that made the sky appear black all the way to Chicago. In 1938, Mary Mallon died at North Brother Island, New York City. Better known as Typhoid Mary, she was an infamous household cook who was responsible for major outbreaks of typhoid in the New York City area in 1904, 1907, and 1914. Mallon's case showed that a person could be a carrier without showing any outward signs of being sick, and it led to most of the health code laws on the books today. And in 1973, Arturi Virtanen died, a Finnish biochemist. His investigations led to the discovery of the AIV method. He found that cows fed silage preserved with a mixture of hydrochloric and sulfuric acid produced milk the same in taste from that of cows fed on normal fodder and were just as rich in vitamins A and C. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You know, there's a story here at the University of Illinois.
There is just one thing you can't forget, my boy.
And it is a very true story.
It's an old established rule.
Our undergraduate library, the place where students go and study, our undergraduate library is built underground. And that happened for only one reason.
Oh, you can't throw shit on the corn. It'll die as sure as you're born. No, sir, we don't mess around. Now that berry's underground, because you can't throw shade on the corn.
Nope, you just can't throw shade on the corn in the Morrill plots.
Yeah, that's right. You know, The story about the undergraduate library is the fact that it's actually built underground rather than above ground to reduce any impact of shade on the Morrill plots.
That's agronomist Bob Dunker. He takes care of the Morrill plots and says the undergraduate library isn't the only building adjusted downward to keep the sunshine on the corn. And it's all happened for good reason.
It really is a historical continuum, kind of a living museum. You know, It was established in 1876, and it's the longest continuous research plot in America, and actually has the longest continuous corn plot in the world that has been documented. And you know, over the series of that time, it's been pretty much managed very similar as far as rotational scheme and looking at the effects of both fertilizer and crop rotation on soil quality.
Well, the Morrill plots, established in the mid-late 1800s, are just about as old as the University of Illinois itself. This land grant was established in 1867. The Morrill plots were much bigger back then. Three of the original plots remain, says Bob Dunker.
You know, originally there were 10 plots in the Morrill plots, and now there actually are three, plots 3, 4, and 5, and Plot 3 has been in continuous corn since 1876. You know, Plot 4 has been in a two-year rotation from 1876 until 1967, was in a corn-oats rotation, and then soybeans were swapped out for oats after that period to more closely reflect what our typical agriculture is for this day. And Plot 5 has always been in a three-year rotation. It still has oats. It's a corn-oats alfalfa rotation, and so that's our three-year rotation. You know, only every 6 years, because of the way the rotations occur, is it in continuous corn, and that's when we can actually measure the responses of the different treatments because we have a uniform crop.
The continuous corn plots, the plot that hasn't ever been seeded with anything other than corn, typically has the lowest yields. The three-year corn oats alfalfa rotation has the best long-term average yield. You can come see the Morrill plots for yourself on the University of Illinois campus. They're just to the east of the underground undergraduate library. The Morrill plots song, as performed by the other guys, they've been an a cappella group on campus
since 1968. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.